Here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host, back in the chair after a few days off. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me. I will share it with the people unless you don't want me to. Of course, I won't do it. Coming up in the second hour of the show on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon will be back. She is the co-host of Holistic Living. We're doing a rebroadcast, actually, of self-checking. A popular conversation that we had early on. So you don't want to miss that. But Lamont Summers will be here in person. He is the assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He will have the media report, and we got a lot to get to, as usual, on the media report. Coming up a little bit later in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network, reporting on law enforcement and politics. We have a special guest, my main man, D. Watkins, author of The Cook-Up and The B-Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. That's coming up a little bit later. And before we get to D. Watkins and the Mod Squad, K. Wise Whitehead, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, professor, Loyola University of Maryland professor, author, public intellectual, and incredible guest host of First Edition is in the studio with me, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Thank you, first of all, for doing a great job sitting in the chair while I was gone. You, as well as Stephen and Taya of the Real News Network, and of course, Adam Jackson of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, I thank you all for coming in and doing the job so greatly in my absence. Appreciate that.
Not a problem at all. Thank you.
And let me just say also thank you to all the people that have been reaching out to me as I've celebrated my birthday.
At the spa with steak.
Yes, steak at the spa. And all the people who continue to congratulate me on assuming the position as Baltimore editor of the Afro newspaper as well. A lot of really lovely sentiments being sent my way. As a matter of fact, I mean, many, but my friend Dwight Pettit sent me a handwritten, hand-signed note to officially make, I mean, it kind of felt kind of weird for me to get a note with, you know, kind of an official proclamation. But Dwight, thank you all, everybody, thank you for your very, very a beautiful sentiment from Michael Mitchell, as a matter of fact, on behalf of the Mitchell family.
Oh, very nice.
Really beautiful. So thank you all for the kindness and graciousness that you all have shown in these good days, moving into that chair at the Afro. And so thank you. Appreciate it. But K. Wise Whitehead, we have to talk about the 4th of July.
Yes, we do.
Speaking of the Afro, you have penned an incendiary commentary, and very much welcome, as far as I'm concerned, from my position as editor. These are the types of conversations that we need to have right now, especially in these days and times that we find ourselves with the 45th president of the United States still clinging to the White House, even if it may be a kind of a tenuous clinging, I don't know. But I want to just read the first paragraph, and this commentary will appear in the Afro tomorrow. It says, "I had a moment during Sunday service when my pastor asked us to stand, turn toward the American flag, and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I cringed as everyone quickly stood, placed their hands over their hearts, and proceeded to recite the pledge without question and without hesitation. I sat there fighting against my desire to stand and be obedient because I knew that as a black person in America, I could not pledge my allegiance to this racist nation or to our bigoted president. Those are powerful sentiments, but I think that they are sentiments held by millions of people in our country.
I think so. It's very interesting. And first, let me just say I am excited, beyond excited, to have a piece in the Afro and to be working with the Afro over the next months, years, hopefully.
Hopefully years.
Doing a monthly op-ed column. I love writing opinion editorials. I always feel like I have to toe the line and be clear about what I'm saying because the kickback is so great when you dare to tread into any waters that upset this untenuous balance of power that we have in America. And when I say untenuous, is that all the power is resting on one side and they don't want you to come and attack that. But I feel that with the Afro and with the long history of the Afro and the amazing work that the Afro is doing, that I can finally say some of the things that I write down in my journal, some of the things that I think about. And so this op-ed here, where I really struggled with trying to understand the 4th of July, I always have struggled with that, but even more so at this time. The title of it is called Blood on the Roots, of course, which is kind of thinking about the song, you know, The Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday, which is talking about, of course, lynched bodies hanging from the trees, and that it is always as black people. It is our blood that's at the root of these trees. And I do this whole thing around how it's our blood that's actually helping to till the soil, that is helping to kind of grow this notion of white American exceptionalism. So in this piece, I talk about how I struggle with this, this moment of cognitive dissonance,
right?
Or as W.E.B. Du Bois says, you know, where you have this, double consciousness. Double consciousness, where I'm sitting here as a black person in America who is both a descendant of enslaved people who chose to survive life in America, and a descendant of American veterans who died trying to protect American life. So I have this war going on within me that I think that a lot of black people have. I mean, I want to stay and I want to be a part of this wonderful American dream, but I'm often feeling like I'm being pushed out.
Well, I mean, and part of perhaps the main reason why we all want to be a part of this American dream is because we built this country.
Yeah.
And given the 45th president who occupies the White House right now, it seems like our presence, our contribution to America is being questioned now more than, at least in my lifetime. I can't remember when there's been so much opposition, overt, covert, and in every way possible, from open opposition. I mean, people emboldened to be, there's no other way to put it, but emboldened to be racist, to be audaciously racist, if we want to craft a phrase. I've never experienced anything like it. And I just wonder day by day, literally day by day, I pretty much have checked out on checking in on Trump.
Right.
But I wonder day by day how we are doing collectively. I mean, we deal with the issues that we deal with in Baltimore, issues of violence and homicide and all of that. But the umbrella under which we all operate, and the man sitting, I don't know if he's sitting under the umbrella, but just a Trump nation on the 4th of July, it really causes us, especially people of African ancestry, to go inward and think about what it really, really means.
I think that is the point that we have come from. I did some thinking over the weekend about where we are historically. I mean, I think about Franklin Roosevelt and the fireside chats and the way that people listen to the radio for a sense of stability. I think of, you know, during the time of the civil rights movement, cities on fire and people looking to Kennedy and then to Johnson to just add an air of stability, that of security. You know, I think of the calls to Dr. King's widow Alito when he was assassinated, coming from the White House, that we hear you and that we see you. I think, I mean, this may, you know, rub people the wrong way, but I do think about Bush at 9/11, that there was this sense that we have this cowboy in the White House who's going to make sure that we are protected. Now, we know that has spilled over into a thousand things, but at that moment, his show of strength made people feel like, you know what, I'm safe. I can go outside because we have people sitting on this wall to protect us. I think that those days where we look to the White House for some stability, like we did under President Obama in a lot of ways, those days are gone. President Trump is not the man or the president, because the president doesn't necessarily have to be a man, although it's always been a man in this country. He is not the president that we need. And for many of us, if we look at the popular vote, he's not even the president that we wanted. He was the president that we were given. And in that sense, he is now living out every teenager's dream. His parents are away for the week. He has a house. He has a budget. He has access to getting beer. You know, he can have, you know, parties and drugs. And he is doing everything almost without adult supervision. And I do think that this is a time for conscious folk, first of all, and then for conscious Black folk more specifically, to really think about what it means to wrestle with this double consciousness in America, to really think about what does it mean to stand up and put your hand over your heart and pledge allegiance to a country that reminds you over and over and over again that you belong. And then I think about, you know, Frederick Douglass, who said, you know, in the mid-1800s, when they were talking about whether or not Black folk need to leave the country. Remember Lincoln, you know, had actually purchased land down in Central America. He's like, you know, we're going to move all the Black people there because Black people and white people cannot live together in the same land. This is President Lincoln, Emancipation Proclamation. But Frederick Douglass was one of the first people to say no. He said, we cannot leave this country because we built this nation. Our blood is mixed with the soil. We belong here. We are Americans. We are what it means to be American. So this is our country, and it's a country that we're wrestling with, and I think that's okay. I don't think there's anything wrong with to love a country and critique it at the same time.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, back in the chair after a bit of a vacation.
I'm laughing at the steak and the spa.
In the studio with Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead, professor at the University of Loyola, Maryland, also an author, also a great co-host, guest host of First Edition. I want to read a little bit more from your op-ed that is going to appear in the Afro tomorrow, Dr. K.
I cannot wait, by the way. I'm very excited about it.
You say, I am the Sankofa bird who flies forward across the red, white, and blue landscape with rivers that run deep with the blood of innocent Black and brown people, while hopelessly keeping my head turned in search of something else, of somewhere else. This feeling of Black restlessness, despair, frustration, and anger are not new. It always feels like it is our blood that is on the leaves and on the roots, fertilizing the soil that feeds the American dream of white exceptionalism. We have long felt like we do not belong here. And I suspect that feeling, and we alluded to this earlier in the conversation, that feeling that we've always had, that sense of restlessness, has only been magnified with the election of this man who is not fit to be president of the United States, quite frankly.
He's not. I was looking back at some of Trump's earlier tweets, and for those who watched the Twitter line, I was looking at some of the tweets he tweeted out during the Baltimore uprising, when he was talking about how President Obama had no control over the thugs that are burning down Baltimore, and how he tweeted out that, you know, thanks to President Obama, there won't be a Black man in the White House for generations to come, that it was always the Blackness that was on display that some people conveniently forget. I think that because we have a very dangerous man. And when I'm talking about dangerous, I'm talking about a man who speaks without any sense of what his words what will happen with his words. A man who doesn't understand that he has the power of the Oval Office and the power of this country behind him. A man who does not understand that though it may splash around the White House, his words have the ability to ripple everywhere else, and he can change directions of nations based upon what he tweets and writes. I think it is a powerful position to be the head of one of the most powerful countries on this planet. And that power is now resting in the hands of what I call an adolescent anarchist.
Well, and this is, I mean, and to make it even more plain, I mean, this is a silly man. Yeah. Who is the
petty, childish,
silly man who is, again, occupying the most powerful office on the face of the earth. And this is a man who tweeted out, I mean, he has this ongoing thing with Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. Talked the issue of blood coming up with connected to women. And this seems like a sick individual. And I don't throw that term around casually as if I'm a psychiatrist. But who else would ascend to the White House and still believe that they can behave in this manner? I mean, this is I don't know anybody. When the whole thing came out about the grabbing of the women's genitalia, I remember commenting saying, I've never in all the locker rooms I've been in my life, I've never heard a man ever. Heard a man speak like that. And to know that this man was given a pass and allowed to be or assigned or whatever, however you want to characterize it, president of the United, this is beyond incompetence. This is something else, it seems like.
I think this is, as it was quoted, I think, in the New York Times, this is truly a white lash moment. If people follow Charles Blow, he does an op-ed for the
columnist.
New York Times. Oh, it comes out on Monday and Thursday. That's amazing. That is what I aspire to do with the Afro, to do those type of columns. But he did a great column called The Obama Obsession, and talking about the ways in which Trump, who came to power railing against Obama, who came to power challenging Obama's, you know, birth certificates,
sure.
You know, came to power challenging Obama's transcripts, his education, came to power as a direct result of having a black man in the White House. And he is now obsessed with not just undoing everything President Obama has done, but obliterating President Obama's from people's memory. Here is a man who, at the core, I really believe, hates black people. And I don't care. People can say what they want to say. He has a hatred for blackness, and he seems to have a real hatred and or disdain for women. And it comes across, he has mocked the disabled. He has said things that no rational person would say outside the table. But I just want to poke a little bit, though, Sean, because what it seems like from the White House, because there's an attitude that trickles down. So he has made it okay to say the things you would never say out loud. And I say that because when you challenge President Trump in this era of Trump online, when you write an op-ed that challenges him, when I write a Facebook page that challenges him, it's not that people get online anymore and say, oh, Kay, I hate your words and I'm going to boycott you. Now it's like, you know what, you need to die, if you are a woman, oh, you need to be raped. I mean, you know, that is the pushback we're getting, which I believe it is a tone from the White House. You can say whatever you want. You can mock people, say things, threaten people, and still ascend to the highest office in this land, because we will give you a pass because you are white and you are male.
Let me take a phone call real quick. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hill.
Hey, Leo.
Brother Burroughs, welcome to the show.
Yes, good evening and happy birthday.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
Glad you, old man. I'm glad you're back.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I must tell you that the Donald the Actor Trump, as I've called him, has succeeded along with a number of other white men and rich white men at that, at dividing and conquering some of the black people or Negroes in this country. We fighting each other at his behest in some instances. I don't see a difference between a racist Democrat and a racist Republican. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the same people. Donald Trump is the mad dog running through the hinterland of the American heartland. And we must not and will not tolerate anything short of gaining first-class citizenship. We're still second-class citizenship in America in 2017. That is outrageous. I am not colorblind, and I'm tired of black folks who want to be politically correct making statements to the effect that, oh, well, I don't see color. Well, no, you don't. Do you see the Ku Klux Klan? Do you see these rednecks running with Confederate flags? I see at 1406, in my neighborhood, I see a Confederate flag, Confederate flag and a Confederate monument in Bolton Hill. You know, they Glorious Invictus is.
I was just standing in front of it the other day, Leo. Literally, I was standing in front of it, thinking about how we could blow it up. I shouldn't say that.
Well, I'm not gonna saying do it, I'm going to leave it there because I'm going to lead the charge when I teach institutional racism and the ramifications thereof on Mount Royal Avenue. It is
all right,
1400 block. Then we're going to have a prize example of the Daughters of the Confederacy in 1903 erecting that monument and how it still prevails right today as part of the artscape, by the
right,
way.
Right.
That's within the artscape boundary.
Indeed. So, Brother Burroughs, we got to keep moving. I want to ask you this question, K-Wise Whitehead, before we wrap up. And it's a question that you ask in your commentary, again, that will appear in the Afro. You ask, you want to answer the Frederick Douglass question, quote, what to the slave is the 4th of July? What to the slave is the 4th of July in 2017? What is in your mind?
And that's what I was thinking about, because every 4th of July for the last couple of years, at least as much as I can remember, there's always been a reading of Frederick Douglass's classic, I think one of his best speeches ever, that deals with what it means to be black and to be enslaved in America. And if people haven't read it, what to the slave is the 4th of July? He said this, you know, 165 years ago, he asked this question. He was asked to speak on July 5th, purposely not on the 4th, because he would not speak on the 4th. They asked him for the 4th. He said, I will not speak on the 4th, but I will speak on the 5th. And so he spoke on July 5th. He's like, you know, you've asked me to come here. You know, what does this mean? And he drew this whole long story about how our nation fought for freedom and how you then, because you have to understand, oppression makes people wise, is what he said. And they fought for their freedom. So if they fought for their freedom and we can celebrate them, how much more should enslaved people fight for their freedom? And why can't we support them? That there is a very short step between where he was standing and where he was when he was enslaved down here, of course, in Baltimore. So the question that I'm wrestling with, he said then that this means nothing to us. This is not our 4th of July. You celebrate, we mourn. You're happy, we're sad because you're free and we are not. I'm asking the same question and I'm coming up with the same answer. I want to say that, you know, it's taken 165 years, but we've gotten there. But we have not. So my question is, what to the black person in 2017 is a 4th of July? It is still not our holiday. We still need to look to Juneteenth, the day when all black folks found out that they were free in this country.
Dr. K-Wise Whitehead is Assistant Professor of Communication and African and African American Studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland. She's an author, public intellectual, and a great writer. Thank you, K-Wise Whitehead, for joining me. Appreciate it.
Anytime,
sir. Can't wait to see the finished product in print tomorrow.
I look forward to it.
In Afro Newspaper. Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janison, Taylor Graham. We have a special guest, Dee Watkins, author of The Cook Up and The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Host, making the transition from Dr. KY's Whitehead to the work of the Mod Squad. That is Stephen, Janice, and Taya Graham of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks. Great to see you, Sean.
And thank you for sitting in for me on my days off.
It was our pleasure. I was worried it wasn't going to happen again because we had a little takeover of the happy hour.
Well, we had some go-go.
We had some go-go music. Like, we were worried we might have started something.
See, we shouldn't have told him.
Uh-oh.
He didn't know.
I'm secretly not, I secretly do not have an aversion to go.
Did you hear how hard it was for him to get that out of his mouth? That did not
hard.
Roll off the tongue.
But I don't mind go-go music, especially when I'm partying. I mean, if I'm partying, you know what I mean?
That was tough for you to say, though.
Yeah. Didn't really flow, Sean. Yeah. I'm not feeling it.
We have an actual, guest star in the studio. Mm-hmm. He's a guest star.
Yes,
D. Watkins,
definitely.
Author of The Cook Up and the B-Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, is in the studio as well. Brother, it's always good to see you, man.
Hey, it's a pleasure. It's nothing really wrong with go-go music. I mean, you like mambo sauce too. You know, I got some D.C. people I can introduce you to.
You know, I mean, and it's interesting that you're saying that because you are like the quintessential Baltimore dude. Like, yes. I am the quintessential Baltimore dude. And so, you know. Yeah, that's why we kind of.
They love me in D.C. though.
Like,
I've been going to schools in D.C. I helped donate like thousands and thousands of books to D.C. I taught writing workshops at a bunch of different high schools.
Cool. Good
students at Thurgood Marshall and at Duke Ellington and at Merrick and Northwestern and all that. Like, I've been making my D.C. round.
So now you're gonna make me behave myself and that. Be more.
I'm like an honorary Joe, honorary Mo. What they say.
That's good to know. Maybe I'll straighten my act up a little bit and be more embracing of my brothers and sisters in the district. But it seemed like me being away, it didn't stop the homicide situation in our city. As a matter of fact, it hit home for me again. My dear friend Danielle Brown lost her son to violence, the stepson of Warren Brown. Cody.
I know. I knew Shorty. He was a good little kid.
Good
man.
Dude.
Yeah.
I knew him literally when he was a little boy, and to see him grow up, become this football playing dude.
She used to bring him to the Marriott, and we used to play basketball. He was like the young little 14-year-old kid out there bumping with the grown dudes.
Yeah,
man, it was messed up.
Yeah. But the point is that, you know, these numbers, we keep talking about numbers, but every number has a story. You know, every story has a name connected to it, has a story, has a history, has family, has people, has loved ones, people who are going to mourn the loss of those people. And that's something we have to focus on as a city, because when we get caught up in numbers, it's just easier to say, well, it's not me, it's not my people, but it's all of us, you know. And that's the thing that hopefully we can refocus on as we try to get a grip. I don't even know what to say as far as try to get a grip, because I don't know what that I don't really know what that means. I just know that we have to fundamentally make changes as individuals, I guess. I'm gonna ask you, D. This will be the third year in a row, pretty much. If we continue on the pace that we're continuing, that we've seen this. I mean, I don't know. We can talk about record and epic violence, but we've always had epic violence in Baltimore in our lifetimes. So, what do you think about where we are in 2017 as we go forward and we keep dealing with the same things over and over again?
So a lot of these killings, they hit home for me too, because I know these people, and if I don't know them, like, I might know their big brothers or their fathers or something like that. Like, my homeboy Dion just got killed. His name Moneybags, and like, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation. But I still have hope. Like, and I think I tell myself, you know, because I sit back and you know, I try to listen and observe more than running my mouth and just acting off of emotions. I try to just sit back and just consume everything that's going on around me. And one of the things I see that frustrates me is most of the people who are really talking about how the city has no hope, they don't do anything. Or most of the people who are saying that, yo, these kids are crazy, you know, it's not the cops' fault, it's not you know, society's fault. It's this, you know, it's we're gonna put all the weight on these individual people that's doing these things. They don't do anything. They just like they're commentators that commentate from a drone like perspective. It's like, okay, you was able to make it. You was able to make it out. You was able to get a job. You was able to, you know, move to White Marsh and get like a little bum family or something. That's cool. Like, that's cool. But it's like, what are you really doing for people? Like, what are you doing for people? So for me, you know, it hurts, and I do get sad and I do get depressed when it's people that I know and when it's people that I don't know as well. But at the same time, I just think, well, I'm working really hard to try to change these things with the workshops, with the mentorships, with the stuff I do in schools. But then I'm working with people like Cardoni Fidel, like Tony Lewis in D.C., like other people who do the same work. And we all care about we care about our community. We care about people, and we're trying our best. And I feel like we're and this type of I can't even call it activism. I don't know what to call it. But this type of connection that some of the people who I respect a lot, you know, what Devin Allen does with cameras, like, you know, and teaching kids how to be photographers. This type of connection and using art and language and words and the ability to learn how to think critically and to make better decisions wasn't there for me. I'm not going to speak for nobody else, but for me, when I was coming up, I didn't have people telling me how I can use some of the things that I like and create things that I love and then spread them things with other people. And so I think I'm working towards building a foundation of something that I could never imagine. But I think there's so many people that's going to, like, you know, when I'm all old and dusty, you know, they're going to be able to push me in a corner, and they're going to take it to a higher level because they're going to have all of these skills and resources that I didn't have. So, you know, it's going to get bad before it gets better, but we still got to do the work.
Stephen and Taylor, yeah. One of the other people who lost their lives was Dione, I believe it's pronounced, Smith, who was the younger brother of T.J. Smith, the spokesperson for the Baltimore Police Department. I mean, for T.J., who is part of his job is to report, or rather talk, to announce the fact that homicides take place, crime takes place, to be the spokesperson, the face for the Baltimore Police Department, to learn about the death of his younger brother on the job.
Yeah, that's what he told the Sun reporter. Yeah,
is something that, you know, part of the reason why, you know, I'm bringing this up is that, you know, when my mother was killed in 2004, I swore that I didn't want anybody to ever, that I knew, to ever feel what I had to go through during that time immediately, and then the years afterwards. And to constantly see people who I know directly or indirectly going through it, it's difficult to take.
I think at this point the violence in Baltimore has gotten to a place where I don't think I know anyone who hasn't been touched by violent crime, who hasn't lost a loved one. Now he's from Newark, Delaware, but even I lost a cousin to gun violence. And I think it's you know, the work, like you were mentioning, Dee, that you're doing is so important, because I feel like our city's been traumatized. I feel like there are young people who've become so used to violence that the trauma has gone so deep that they don't even that they don't even duck and cover when they hear the shots go off. They just expect to hear the shots. It's not a shock to them. They expect to live surrounded by violence and to be able to roll that back. The amount of work that we have to do in Baltimore to make people safe again, it's just so much.
Well, you know, we were talking to Daniel Webster, you know, who is works for the Bloomberg School at Johns Hopkins, and he was talking about the Homicide Commission findings, which, you know, basically said that most of the homicides are not, you know, necessarily drug related, but a large majority of them are conflict related, you know, simple conflicts. And years ago, I was interviewing this philosopher, Alfonso Lingus, who is pretty somewhat famous in the academic circles. And he said something about murder that really struck me. He said, murder is an absolute act. You know, it's like the ultimate thing that you can do to a person because it's irrevocable. You can never change it. So if people are willing to commit to the absolute act against a human being for a slight or some small conflict that can't be resolved, as Dee was talking about, then we don't really understand our community in any depth, the pain that exists within it. It's almost unfathomable to us because to take that kind of act in that context means that you really are completely devoid of any sense of sort of human proportion, you know. And I think even though, you know, all of us have been writing about this stuff and talking about it, it still feels like I don't really, you know, have ever comprehended it in a way that I understand. Sure. And I don't know if I do, what it would be like to decide to pick up a gun and shoot someone because they talked to my girlfriend or something, or they owed me $20. I mean, I don't know if I understand it.
And it's part of the reason why I'm happy to be writing about and on a weekly basis bringing in the Erica Bridgeford from community mediation and the Baltimore ceasefire, because that's, it's vital work that she does and her organization does. But that conflict resolution piece, man, that mediation piece is so important, because I say it over and over again, there are cats who are just coming home, there are cats who are home, and the recurring theme is, I heard somebody is trying to fill in the blank, trying to get me, trying to hurt me, trying to do this, trying to do that. And the automatic reaction so many times is, I'm going to get him before he gets me. This is this cycle of violence that we seem to be in right now, that if we just were able to, or if more people were just able to, it seems that if more people were able to resolve conflicts on a basic level, we could do better. I mean, what do you think about that, D?
I think that, you know, in response to you and what Stephen said as well, is that it's generations and generations and generations of just mass rejection. Like, it hurts. Everybody can't deal with that. Everybody can't deal with it. So it's like, I mean, you know, if you can rock with Hopkins, or you can rock with Under Armour, you can bang with them and get money with them and be able to, like, have some opportunity and, you know, some tax breaks, and you know, you can claw your way out of these situations. But I'm saying, like, where I'm from, like, I know people that, like, had nothing but doors shut in their face their whole life, while they get to sit back and within just a stone throw away, they can see all of the money, all of the opportunity, and all of the everything that ain't never going to come to them. That type of that can make you crazy. That can make you pick up a gun and blow somebody's head off, especially if you got to deal with trying to survive. Like Bloomberg Magazine said, this is the worst place in America for a black man to grow up. Baltimore City. It's the worst place in the country. So it's like, you know, whatever public official was responsible for allocating funds and looking out for developers and developing Harbor East and not hiring black people and all that from Baltimore City to work, whoever's responsible for that, whatever that is, or whoever's pushing those buttons, like what you really expect? Like, you can dangle wealth in front of people all the time and dangle opportunity in front of people all the time, and then and you just keep it far away. Just, you know, you put it close enough so that they can just never touch it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like,
I mean, the point is, we have these conversations on the air, we talk to people and engage people off the air with the work that they do to try to move that money around, right? To get a bit of more of a trickle down. I don't want a trickle down. I want a daily.
And it's the money's making it, and then it gets to certain people and it just goes away. Well, and so the good reporting, and I don't, you know, or maybe I haven't saw this story, but we need to know where the funds go and who are the people that were responsible for getting those funds, where they were supposed to go.
80% of the $500 million budget for the police department goes to York, Pennsylvania, right? I mean, 80% of the police officers don't live in the city, right? Because we were just talking to Neil Franklin, and, you know, he was saying how policing has been incentivized to destabilize black communities. You know, I mean, that's what he said.
It is profitable to go into black communities
and destabilize,
to engage in civil forfeiture, to literally rip the assets from the community. Yeah. There is profit.
It's
there.
It's profitable. And so, you know, if you could take it from that, just from that perspective, and roll that back a little, because we know the Safe Streets program, which is community-based conflict resolution, you know, it was totally defunded in the budget. It took the city council basically rejecting the budget to get Safe Streets to go. Now, I don't know if Safe Streets is great or bad, but at least it's something different.
I know Safe Streets stops some people that I know personally from getting murdered, flat out.
There you go.
I know. And if you can save one life,
right?
And for the people, like the two, three people come to mind just off the top of my head.
That's what, for a total budget, 1 week's worth of overtime of the Baltimore City Police for a yearly budget.
But listen to,
1 year.
But
sorry.
Listen, but no, but listen to it. Listen to it. Safe Streets, and everything that I've heard was that Safe Streets was doing work. That's all I've heard. Nobody mm-hmm. ever said anything disparaging to me about it. All I heard was that mm-hmm. they were doing work and they were making a – I mean, you hear the phrase make a difference all the time, but that Safe Streets was for real making a difference. They came that close for wiping it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it worked, because they saw something work.
Okay, here's the fact. The only administration that actually budgeted for Safe Streets out of the actual fiscal budget was the Dix administration. Blake's administration and even Pew are looking for grants. They wanted grant funding to fund it. But they would not use city funds to fund mm-hmm. this since Dixon. So that's why it's always been under siege, because it's grant money. And even though the program, if you said, you know, if you save one life, it's worth it, the city doesn't want to fund it.
But look where Dixon come from, and then look where yeah. and look where Blake come from. Look at their backgrounds mm-hmm. and look at the type of people mm-hmm. they associate themselves with. Look how they carry it. Like, it's levels to everything. Like,
sure, yeah, I know
when I walk in certain spaces and people know where I come from, that budget ain't worth, my life not worth that budget. That's but true. he from this block, he from this neighbor, he from this project, cross him out the budget, because that's not what we want to invest in. But then everybody want to talk about the murders.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that if we could pour, you know, $20-30 million in Safe Streets, if, you know, D, what says it, we could save 20-30 lives maybe. I mean, that would make a big difference. Or
it would make a big difference. I mean, the whole thing, the reason why in some ways our conversations become absurd is because we know kind of what we need to do as a
yes.
city. And
yeah.
it comes down to, as far as governance is concerned, it comes down to priorities.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they know
yes.
what they I mean, that, I mean, so, I mean, to have those conversations over and over again is insane.
Look, Sean, this year they were talking about cutting police budgets like heretical. It was like they're going to take Galileo down, you know, and just because it was like so crazy that someone would say, let's take a little bit, teeny bit, like a couple million.
But they wound up adding money to the police budget.
Yes, they did. They did yes. in the end, even though everyone was going around saying, let's take a little bit out and put into this, put that. And in the end, it didn't work. It didn't happen, really. And it just shows it. We, you're right. It's almost like we're, you know, in the Einsteinian.
Just keep sending money to York, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well,
it's
and that's
smart.
Where it goes.
Just very smart.
Yeah,
move.
It's nice up in New York.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9.
Which actually isn't true. But.
I'm Sean Yos, your host, in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Also in the studio with special guest D. Watkins, author of the book The Cook Up and the B-Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. I had that memorized in my head now, and that's good. We're talking about politics and law enforcement as we do on Wednesdays. Let me take a couple of phone calls. Let's go to Oscar in Baltimore. Let's see what Oscar has to say. Oscar, good to hear your voice. Been
hey,
a while.
How you doing?
I'm all
good
right.
evening.
Well, first of all, my condolences go out to anyone who's lost loved ones through violence. I don't care when it happened or how it happened. Mm-hmm. My condolences to them. Second of all, the architect of the universe, he hears and he sees. Now, I believe in karma. When you stand up and defend the indefensible, not the defenseless like some dummy said, or the indefensible, when you justify police killing an unarmed man, you spend the whole trial of Freddie Gray's trial defending those police. When you stand up on a daily basis and speak for the police department and defend what you know as a police officer and a black man in this country is going on wrong, that's karma, brothers. That is karma. Mm. And another thing, Ernest and I have been saying for years, it doesn't matter who the police commissioner is. It doesn't matter who the mayor or the governor or the president of the United States. They can't stop a homicide. They can't. But now that they have a friend who they, and Kevin Davis, now I don't have nothing against Kevin Davis, because I know no commissioner can stop a homicide. But now there's these certain people on talk radio, Dumb and Dumber, are now saying that the police commissioner can't stop a homicide. Well, we've been telling you that. But because they know that the police commissioner can open up a cold case file on your behind, you're going to defend them. So we've been saying all the time that a police commissioner can't stop a homicide, and it doesn't matter where the police work. It doesn't matter where they live. It doesn't matter if they get overtime, straight time, or crooked time. That's not going to stop homicide.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's bottom line. So you got to start listening. And don't be having people come on who absolutely don't know what they're talking about. I told you years ago that they can't stop. Let me say this last thing. Because some crazy slave-owning white men 100 years ago said you have a right to carry a gun, a Second Amendment. We need to get rid of the Second Amendment. You're talking about ceasefire. Right. How about not having anything too far?
All right, Oscar. Thank you. Let's go to Gene in Pikesville. Gene, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Sean, I had no idea, your circumstances in reference to your mother.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my condolences. I know late, but...
It never goes away, so I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. God bless you, man.
Thank you, brother.
At this point, what I hear sometimes is we talk about, okay, what the problem is, who the problem is, and who's killing who and so forth. Okay, so if, let's say, everything changes for the best, is it going to change for the best, or do we have another option? And to me, did the Vietnam thing and grew up in my informative years, during the 60s, what we did was we considered, radical politics, communism, revolution. And so that was a consideration. It was suicidal. And J. Edgar Hoover, et cetera. But, in Europe, the first generation of kids who are born there, the Muslim kids, they some of them choose ICE. So if we become politically astute, then I think they're going to look at us like, then Homeland Security is the number one priority. And if we some of us choose, that road, then we're the number one problem in America, not just 360 people, 65% of 600,000.
Right.
I don't hear what are the choices, and when we save ourselves and our children, how are we going to do it?
All right. Gene.
And I think it's what you guys are talking about, right?
All right. Yep. Gene, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Yeah, I think the level, I don't know. I think that there's a level of frustration all around that, is pervasive. But, anyway.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Where are these guns coming from?
Well, that's a,
straight
that's a
up.
Great question.
Like, I remember, when I was coming up, you can get a gun. You can get it easy, but you need that $350, $400. I know people that can't even, they don't got $10 for food, but they got pistols. Where are these guns coming from? Where
That's
do
a
they
great question.
I know. Is there a gun factory in East Baltimore? I don't know.
I saw some really, really over the past, I'm gonna say 10 years, mm-hmm. I've saw some really nice guns, like with cooling kits and all. I saw nice guns, 50 shot max with the cooling kits, mm-hmm. so they don't over. Like I saw nice ones. Mm. nice ones. So, I don't, that's just my question. Like, I'm not, like, when you see the Baltimore police officers' Twitter, they mm-hmm. recovering, old revolvers from, the Civil War. what I'm saying? And they getting, beat up max and jammed mm-hmm. up. But I saw some nice, nice guns, and I just want to know where they come from.
Where's that equipment coming from? And where are those drugs coming from? There are no opiate fields in Baltimore City either. So we're obviously a point where an incredible amount of drugs and guns are being imported, and it's being allowed to happen, right? So we have to ask ourselves, why are we the center of these drugs and guns? Why is it being allowed to pour into our communities?
Well, you can look at the Gun Trace Task Force for that answer, because a lot of guys say there were plenty of guns on them.
Right.
And so they must have a source of guns somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's seed. You see the streets with guns, and then you pick them up and say, look, I got a gun.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of arch, but it seems like that's what they were doing. Which, in a matter of fact, two of those officers are now, more officers might plead guilty part of the Gun Trace Task Force, the seven officers. The Sun just published that. So, I mean, they literally, you would get an email from... Like you were talking about, you get an email from Baltimore police media every day that they recovered a gun. So it raises a good. They've taken so many guns off the streets. It seems like they're raining from heaven here.
Right. Yeah.
You mean two of the seven may plead guilty?
Yeah, two more of the seven. I think Marcus Taylor was going to plead guilty, and now two more are going to. It looks like they're going to plead guilty. So they got those guys pretty well.
Mm-hmm. They sure did.
Yeah, but I mean that is a good example of, you know, their job was just basically to take guns off the streets and.
And it sounded like they spent most of their job putting guns on people
who didn't have guns, or
and then getting money.
And then getting money,
and taxing people,
right.
Yes.
And, you know, the destructiveness of something like that can't really be measured. But we measure. I mean, we talk to people who have suffered from it.
They're not being dragged apart in the media enough. Like, I feel like they should be demonized a bit more. Like, I just feel like
I totally agree with you.
Everyone should know their names.
And they're dead to right.
That we should have, like, their profiles, their backstories. We should have, like, deep, like, this should be, like, other police officers making statements talking about, like, you know, what it was like. Like, we should know, like, because if I did something, you're going to hear about it. Like, we knew he was out of his mind. We knew he was going to flip. We knew that guy was one of the bad ones.
You knew Herschel, right? You knew Herschel. People knew
personally,
him.
Personally. I know Daniel, little Daniel personally.
Really?
Yeah, little Daniel had a really bad attitude problem.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people knew that guy. Yeah. Like, he was well known in the city. I mean,
he was a terrorist.
He was not secret.
No, when I was an undergrad, I wrote an essay about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And the essay was basically saying, is that music? Oh, so the essay was basically saying, like, how I feel bad about 9/11. And, you know, I just think, like, you know, the people in my neighborhood aren't responding the way some of the people in college is responding respond every year, because, like, it's like terrorists that just, like, work there. They get a paycheck. Like, and I talked about Herschel. Like, I was looking for that old essay, but I was talking about Daniel Herschel, the terrorist who's, like, terrorizing in the neighborhood. Like, you know, he broke the arms of, I think, an elderly person.
Yeah, body slam.
I mean, you know, very disgusting person, very evil guy.
Yeah.
D. Watkins is author of The Cook-Up and the B-Side. D, thank you for just sitting in with us. We appreciate you, man.
Thank you.
Steven, Janice, and Taya Graham are the Mod Squad.
Yes.
They are reporters for the Real News Network and the Afro.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you both. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks. Always glad to be here,
Fidel,
Sean.
Thank you for sitting in, even though you were just doing your thing. Appreciate you being here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition, Holistic Living and the Media Report. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.